Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. I grew up listening to conversations on Christian Zionism. This idea, developed after the Reformation, received clear articulation in 17th century England, flourished in the 1840s, and has continued down to our own day, anchoring much of the support for the policy of the Israeli government among North American evangelicals and others. Christian Zionists believe that the gathering of Jews in Israel is a requirement for the second coming of Jesus Christ and the unfolding of the end of history. In my home province of Alberta, several forms of this teaching flourished. In the 1930s, both the Premier of Alberta from 1935 to 1943, Bible Bill Eberhardt, and Ellie Maxwell, founder of Prairie Bible Institute in Three Hills, Alberta, spread this teaching through their radio ministries and their Bible teaching. It took root and continues to inform a relationship to Israel, a particular understanding of the Jewish people of whom Jesus Christ was a part, and is used as an effective political tool, garnering support for a whole range of issues. Historians have argued that it also migrated into Jewish, largely secular Jewish circles, and seeded forms of Zionism that are foundational to the Israeli state. One of the foremost Jewish scholars of this matter is Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro. He forcefully argues that Zionism has moved Jewish identity away from the covenant and commandments, which called the Jewish people, as Scripture tells us, to be a holy people and a nation of priests. Zionism has grabbed the limelight and confused the question of what it means to be a Jew. Is Jewishness an ethnicity, a tribal identity, a national identity of one nation among others? Or is it to be a holy people and a nation of priests? Yaakov Shapiro is an emeritus rabbi in Bayswater, Queens, New York. After graduating high school at age 16, he entered a traditional Orthodox program of education and intellectual formation. He's the author of a number of books on Jewish theology and law, on Bible and Talmud. His magnum opus, The Empty Wagon, Zionism's Journey from Identity Crisis to Identity Theft, is a 1,400-page comprehensive historical and ideological treatise on the incompatibility of Judaism and Zionism. He has recently attained international renown with his videos on Zionism, which have been seen by millions worldwide. His 7-minute video on President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel has been viewed close to 2 million times. I welcome you to our conversation on Zionism and the call to be a holy people and a nation of priests.
Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa.
I spent a little time a number of years ago in Lithuania. I had a colleague at OISE, which is the Graduate School of Education at the University of Toronto, and he read a book that I had written on my work in museums and what it means to care about memory and to care about place and to care about historical experience and what have you. Roger had grown up in the textile district of New York in a secular Jewish family, and he was trained in psychology and sociology, taught at OISE for a number of years. His large program of research, which he brought graduate students into, was largely around public memory. He had done work with his graduate students on the Sandinistas, on the Polytechnique in Quebec, where a number of women were murdered. He had begun by doing some work on the early examples of Holocaust museums and had gotten quite concerned and disturbed about what was really going on here. In any case, he wanted to revisit some of that work and look at the archives, like Evo, associated with the Jewish communities in Europe during the Nazi occupation and during the creation of Jewish ghettos and that unbelievable horror. So he asked me if I would join him in that.
I had read, you know, I fell in love with Martin Buber, for better or for worse, and Abraham Heschel. And
condolences.
A number of those people when I was studying a number of years ago. And I had read a number of Jewish writers. But I had never actually walked in the shadow of the Holocaust until I went to Lithuania with him and witnessed that. I'm not sure why I'm telling you this, but only to say that the issue of Zionism and what this actually means and how that is played out both in the forming of the State of Israel, as well as geopolitically, has interested me for some time, and the issue of Christian Zionism, because in my own childhood church, that was present. So I paid attention to those things. What is it about Zionism that you, as a Orthodox Jew, care about and are concerned about?
Zionism was invented as an antidote to Judaism. The relationship between Zionism and Judaism is that Judaism is the disease and Zionism is the cure.
I saw this in Lithuania. I saw it. Lithuania, as you no doubt know, was referred to as the Jerusalem of the North or something of this sort by Zionists who were there, some from Russia and what have you.
Right. You see, this whole idea that Zionism is the national liberation movement of the Jewish people, or self-determination for the Jewish people, or a search to find a safe place for Jews, is all political propaganda designed to sanitize the real motive behind Zionism and to conceal it. And the reason why the real motive needs to be concealed is because if the real history of Zionism, including the motive to create it, was not concealed, then the ideology of Zionism falls apart at the seams. Zionism is a new, innovative, and counterfeit version of Jewish identity. Yesterday, I gave a talk over here discussing Jewish identity. And it's a strange thing, because the Jews are the only group of people that I could think of that are constantly debating, not only them, others are debating what they are. Are the Jews a religion? Are the Jews a tribe? Are the Jews a race? Are the Jews an ethnicity? Are they a combination of one or two or three of the above? Well, if they're a religion, what are you going to do with the atheist Jews? If they're an ethnicity, what are you going to do with the fact that they are Jews of so many different ethnicities? If they are a race, well, what are you going to do with the fact that they are Jews of so many different races? Clearly, Ivanka Trump and the Ethiopian Jews are not of the same race nor of the same ethnicity. They do have a religion in common, but then what are you going to do with somebody like Theodore Herzl, David Ben-Gurion, Benjamin Netanyahu, who do not believe in the Jewish religion? They're not practicing Jews at all. So what are they? Now, there's no group of people anywhere that has such an amorphous and ambiguous definition. So what happened over here? And it's particularly strange, since the Jews have been basically secluded, separate from the rest of society. They've always been educated. Mandatory education, compulsory education, started in the Jewish community about 2,000 years ago. The high priest Yeshua ben Gamla started in the days of the temple. So they've always been literate, always been studying. You know, study is one of the main fundamentals of our religious life. And considering all of this, the lack of assimilation, the studying, the how come they can't figure out, nobody can figure out what they are? Here's the answer. Jewish identity is not a religion, nor an ethnicity, nor a tribe, nor a culture, nor a family. All of those could be refuted. Jewish identity, Jewishness, is religious doctrine. What do I mean by that? There are certain concepts that are invented and defined by the religion. So we're only allowed to eat kosher food. Now, what constitutes kosher food? Well, the religion decides what constitutes kosher food. You can't go to a scientist and ask him what a kosher food is, right? You can't go to a sociologist and ask him what kosher food is. You would have to go to the religion, because the religion invented the concept. It's religious doctrine. You want to know what age a kid gets bar mitzvah at? You can't ask a medical doctor. You'd have to go to the religion and see what the religion says, since a bar mitzvah is religious doctrine. The status of being a Jew, Jewish identity, is also religious doctrine. It means that God gave Moses on Mount Sinai a Torah, which contains 613 mitzvahs, commandments, with many thousands of subcategories, to the Jewish people, and the Jewish people are obligated to fulfill those mitzvahs.
So it's covenant and commandment.
Covenant and commandment, and all the miscellaneous that comes with covenant and commandment. Whoever is obligated in these 613, as opposed to the other seven, there are seven Noahide laws that the whole world is obligated to perform, but whoever is obligated in the 613, according to Judaism, they are Jews. The definition of a Jew is somebody who is obligated to fulfill those mitzvahs. That's it. And who decides who's obligated? Well, the religion decides, because the religion invented the concept of a Jew. So if you want to know what a Jew is, it's religious doctrine. It's not a religion. Yeah, sure, you know why you have atheist Jews? Because the religion says that these Jews, whether they believe it or not, these Jews are obligated, these people are obligated to fulfill these mitzvahs, and therefore they are Jews.
Even if they aren't fulfilling them.
Even if they aren't fulfilling them, even if they deny their obligation, it
right.
doesn't matter. Whatever the religion says is kosher is kosher. Whatever the religion says constitutes a Torah scroll is a Torah scroll. Whatever the religion says constitutes somebody who's obligated in the mitzvahs is someone who's obligated in the mitzvahs, a.k.a. a Jew. That's it. And that's how Jews identified themselves for thousands of years. Now, obviously, if you don't believe in the narrative that God gave Moses the Torah on Mount Sinai and transformed a few million ragtag refugees from Egypt into Jews, which means deputized them into this obligatory covenant, then you're either not going to believe that there is such a thing as a Jewish person, which is what they should disbelieve, because if you don't believe that God gave the laws of kosher, then you're not going to believe that there's any difference between, you know, a cow and a camel, except in the deluded minds of the Jewish people, if you don't believe that. And if you don't believe in that narrative, you're not going to believe that there's any difference between a Jew and a non-Jewish person, because it is only the religion that says there's a difference, and the difference is you're obligated to do these mitzvahs. So people who didn't believe in Judaism, other religions, they had to find another definition of what a Jew is.
So I was at a table of a lovely person that I worked with in the Jewish community quite a number of years ago. She's now of blessed memory. But I was at her table one day when the man who was hired by the local Jewish community organization was there for lunch as well. And one of the first things he said to me was, "You know, David, I'm a Jew. I'm an atheist, but I'm a Jew. I don't go to any of this stuff, sometimes the High Holy East, but I'm a Jew." What's going on?
I'll tell you how that developed. And what happened was that because of the emancipation and enlightenment and the French Revolution and what have you, so Jews had not only freedom of religion, but freedom from religion, if they would so choose. And there are many Jews, that chose they don't want to be religious. It used to be in the olden days, if somebody didn't want a Jew, they would convert to another religion. But in modern times, the last few hundred years, you didn't have to convert to another religion. You could have been totally secular without any religion. They didn't want to become Christians. Even Reform Jews believe that there's a religion called Reform Judaism. But there are people that just said, you know what, we just want to be secular. And that was fine. One of the motivations for not being Jewish is because they thought they would no longer be subject to anti-Semitism. But there are other motivations too. Not everybody wants to be religious. The problem was, in 1881 in Russia, the pogroms started. And even non-religious Jews, were subject to these pogroms. And that created an identity crisis. Why do they hate me, these anti-Semites? I'm Jewish? What makes me Jewish? I'm the same as this Russian who lives outside of the Pale of Settlement. Why do they hate me? What am I? And the anti-Semites, there are different types of anti-Semites. We know there are people who didn't like Jews and said, well, as long as you convert to another religion, I'm good with you. And then there are others, let's say the racial anti-Semites, racial anti-Semitism that started in like the 1800s, that it doesn't matter if you are religious or not, the Jews are a race. Now, this led to an identity crisis on the part of these secular Jews. If we're not Jews, why do they hate us? Why do they kill us? And what happened was that because of the anti-Semites, they were kind of forced into thinking of themselves as an ethnic group.
So it's a legacy of anti-Semitism.
Yes. Now, Jean-Paul Sartre said that it's not the Jew that causes the anti-Semite, it's the anti-Semite that causes the Jew.
Right.
But before him, you know who said it? Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl, who had nothing to do with Jews, with Judaism in the slightest. You know the old joke, what's the difference between Herzl and Jesus?
I assume Jesus was a Jew.
Well, Jesus celebrated Hanukkah and Herzl celebrated Christmas.
I see.
Herzl, he didn't even particularly like Jews. There's so many anti-Semitic statements in Herzl's works. Herzl's letters, he didn't particularly like Jews. And Herzl said that we are a nation against our will. Our enemies have made us into one. Distress binds us together. When he was asked by the British Committee on Immigration what Jewish nationalism is, because that's what he was professing, he said, well, you know what a nation is, and then you put the adjective Jewish in front of it, and a nation is a recognizable group of people, cohesive, bound together by a common enemy. And one of the members of the British Committee asked him, who is the common enemy where Jews are concerned, and he said the anti-Semite, which means that Jewish identity became something more than religion, because of anti-Semitism. They had no common characteristics.
But it's a negative identity.
It's a negative identity. It's a dark doomsday identity. Your whole Jewishness depends upon anti-Semitism. But let's understand what this means. If I may answer one of the first question you asked me, well, you actually asked it to yourself. Mm-hmm. After you mentioned the Holocaust museums, you said, well, why am I telling this to you? Mm-hmm. May I suggest why you would be telling that to me? Mm-hmm. This emphasis on the Holocaust, there was a Pew survey that found that remembering the Holocaust was the most commonly significant aspect of Jewishness among Jews surveyed.
Yeah.
And every town, there's a Holocaust museum. They're not necessarily yeshivas there, Jewish schools, synagogues, but a Holocaust, not museum, a Holocaust memorial there has to be. Because you see, anti-Semitism is what makes you Jewish, according to Herzl. The Holocaust is what, without Holocausts, without the communists, ironically, the communists had Jews amongst them, but the anti-Semitic communists, without persecution, there are no Jews. You see, there's one of two definitions. Either you believe in the Torah's narrative, that God created the Jews, or you say, well, we got to be something else. The anti-Semites decided that we are Jews. You even hear it today all the time. I hear it. Well, non-religious Jews are also Jews because Hitler didn't distinguish. You've heard that. Hitler didn't distinguish. So Hitler becomes the rabbi that decides who's... Do you understand how sick that is? Hitler becomes the rabbi to teach us who's a Jew. That's Judaic doctrine is dictated by Hitler because he didn't distinguish. That makes me Jewish. Do you understand how sick that is? But that's just an evolved version of Herzl's idea of what Jewishness is. Unfortunately, distress unites us. That's it. Now, that definition of... So Herzl decided, you know what? This anti-Semitism stuff, that's a problem. and he's going to solve it. He figured that this is what his book, The Jewish State, is about. Based on his theories, which are all, they're silly, and obviously none of them came true. Once Zionism starts, this is the last page of his book, once Zionism starts, anti-Semitism will end. Once the Jews go back to a land, once they have a land for themselves, doesn't matter where.
Sitka, Alaska.
Alaska, Uganda, mm-hmm. all these places. But Herzl said those places aren't good. We should not choose those places for marketing reasons. We'll get there. Herzl figured that once the Jews separate themselves from everybody else, there won't be anything more for people to hate. He actually went to heads of state and said, look, basically it's a win-win situation. I'm paraphrasing here. You can get rid of your Jews, and, you know, and I'll have my state, and everything's great. So he leveraged anti-Semitism, encouraged anti-Semitism in order to create his state, which the people in Israel, the Zionists, still do today. After there was the Jews killed in Paris, so Netanyahu went to Paris and said, the solution, you know what, Jews, you're welcome to Israel.
Come.
Denmark, Jews come to Israel.
Right, yeah.
Anti-Semitism not only is good for business, for Zionism, but it also defines them. That's what makes them Jewish. Now, there were other theories of what makes somebody Jewish amongst the Zionists. One thing they didn't want. See, the Zionists believed, all of them, that the reason why people hate Jews is because they're so Jewy. Once we make the Jews into normal people, meaning give them normal aspirations, Jews, as religious people, have a mission. Our mission is not, by the way, to be a light to the nations. That's a reform thing. Our mission is, as the Bible says, we should be, I'll say it in Hebrew, Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kodosh. It means a kingdom of priests and a holy people.
Right.
Okay? By way of analogy, think of, I don't know, the Shaolin monks, you know, where they sit a whole day studying their texts and dressed the way they dress and doing the way they do. And that's the way Jews were. The ghetto, by the way, was not started as an anti-Semitic act.
Right.
The first ghetto was when the Jews went into Egypt and they said, we want to live in Goshen amongst ourselves. The great historian, Salo Baron, had a good line. He said the locks on the inside of the ghetto door were there before the locks on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
I would add the locks on the inside of the ghetto door were stronger than the locks on the outside. Later, it became an anti-Semitic act, but the Jews always wanted to be secluded in order to fulfill their mission, as just like, you know, Shangri-La is secluded from the world for the exact same reason.
Or a number of monastic movements.
Fair enough.
That we also have in Christianity.
And Judaism is one of those, is similar in this mm-hmm. sense to those movements in that we need to be secluded, all right? And even now we have, you know, Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods and stuff. It's not a question of antisocial. It's not a question of superior. It's a question of if we want to fulfill our mission as a kingdom of priests and a holy people, this is what we need to do, right? Now, what that also meant that Jews never aspired to things that regular non-Jewish people did. So, for example, there's no such thing as Jewish art throughout the centuries, Jewish architecture, Jewish literature. There is so much Jewish literature, but there's no fiction literature. The Jews produced commentaries on the Bible, poetry, stuff about God, philosophy. No fiction literature until the Enlightenment and German influence. And in sports, no Jewish sports. It wasn't our aspiration. It's not a problem. It's not that sports is a bad thing. It's not that art is a bad thing. It's not that literature is a bad thing. It's just that it's not our thing because our mission is to be the priests. No problem. The Zionists hated this life. Imagine if you don't believe in the religion. Now look at the Jews. No art, no science, no. You're crazy. You're sick. We got to normalize you. That's what started Zionism. You're sick, said Jabotinsky, Vladimir Jabotinsky, one of the founding fathers of Zionism, whose brand of Zionism is dominant in Israel today. His party morphed into what today is the Likud. He said that I know I'm a Zionist because the Jewish people are a nasty people. Their neighbors hate it, and they're right. Its end will be a Bartholomew night. And all the Zionists, they said the Jews are sick. They aspire to sick things. You now have a chance. You had the Enlightenment. You had the emancipation. You're smart people. You're literate people. Okay? You have a culture, a history of studying, right? Of striving for academic excellence. What are you busy with these dusty tomes for? Go out and take advantage and be normal.
So is it fair to say this is another chapter? It is a story in the way in which the secularist agenda developed in Europe.
Amongst the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And what happened was that because assimilation, which was plan A, didn't work to eliminate anti-Semitism, the Zionist figure plan B would be, instead of assimilating as individuals, we're going to assimilate as a people and become another one of the nationalities. See, in 19th century, nationalism was sweeping all over Europe. Yeah. And they figured, look, it worked so good for the Balkan people. It worked so good for everybody. It'll work for us. So now, here's what they have to do. And this was Herzl's theory and other people's theories too. But here's step one. Here's the problem with Zionism. But the plan was, we're going to change the Jews into a nationality, resulting in the Jews aspiring for things and striving for things that normal nations do. Instead of excellence in mastering the Talmud, they'll strive for gold medals, for Nobel Prizes, for create a new app, create a new form of martial arts. You'll have a strong army like normal people want to have, right? Jabotinsky said that basically the character of a Zionist is the opposite of a Jew. Whatever a Jew is, we're going to change into a Hebrew whose character traits will be the opposite of a Yid. Meaning the Zionist project was a plan to transform the Jews from a nation of priests and holy people into a nation like all nations. The question was how to do it. You see, their plan was nationalism. Here, by way of analogy, I always say, let's say I want to convince the Christians. You know what? Christianity is not a religion. It's a baseball team. Jesus was the manager. The Gospels were all stars. And Christians were a baseball team. Just what happened was they got mixed up. And because of priests and pastors and bishops and popes. So they got really mixed up. And they got involved in the supernatural nonsense and religious nonsense. But really...
And they got involved in the foul ball and the sacrifice fly.
Very good. Right. The foul balls. Exactly. Okay. And... As opposed to like certain idol worshiping religions that were into the double header.
That's correct.
So if I want to convince the Christians to become ball players, it won't work if I say Christians drop your religion, become ball players. But if I tell you know what Christianity really is, a baseball team, bring Christianity back to its old glory. I'm going to give you bats and balls, and I'm going to make pinstripe uniforms that say Christians across the chest, and I'm going to let them play. Before you know it, they will identify as a baseball team, and they will look at those that identify Christianity with religion as wackos. That was the Zionist plan. There was a great rabbi, a really great rabbi, who had such foresight. If somebody doesn't believe in like divine inspiration, then he was like just the smartest person in the world. His name was Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. He died in 1918. And he said that the Zionists don't want to destroy Judaism because they need to make a state. They want to make a state in order to destroy Judaism. The Zionist plan was exactly as my imaginary plan for the Christians, but instead of a baseball team, we're going to make them into a nationality. I'm going to give you a state. I'm going to create a language. They invented this language, modern Hebrew, which had absolutely no practical purpose in terms of the safety of Jews, the security of Jews. and just made things harder for people. They could have spoken Russian or Yiddish or even English or some language that they already knew. The creation of modern Hebrew meant that they would have to re-educate people in a new language. But the reason they did it is because language is maybe the most important, if not the, maybe second, most important aspect of a nationality. So we go, and Jews had no national characteristics. They didn't have a land, language, or culture. So guess what? We're going to get you a language. We're going to get you a country. We're going to invent a culture. We're going to give you all the national characteristics so that you will start thinking of yourselves as a nationality. And then, step two, you will aspire to things that nations do. And you can keep your religion. Listen, maybe the Greeks,
sure.
Maybe some of them believe in Zeus today, but Greeks are Greeks, whether they believe in their ancient... We're going to relegate Judaism to, let's say, belief in Zeus, but we're going to be Greeks in the national sense. And then we're going to normalize ourselves, and then there will be no more anti-Semitism because you Jews will not be sick, disgusting people. You will now be normal like the anti-Semites who persecuted you all your lives, so all throughout history.
So when I grew up as a child reading the Bible in the Christian context of my childhood, the narrative of Samuel trying to field the impulse of the people to have a king. This struck me very, very strongly as a child. Does this fit into the narrative?
You know, that's very good. This Rabbi Soloveitchik's son, who inherited his father's astuteness, said that this is exactly what the Zionists want. You see, here's a question. In the Bible there, when the Jews came to the prophet Samuel and said they want a king, he got angry at them because he said, God is your king. Now the question is, there is a commandment in the Bible that says, Soim tosim alecha melech, that you should appoint a king for yourself. So why was Samuel angry? His answer is, he wasn't angry because they said, let's have a king. It's the second half of the sentence. Let's have a king so we could be like everybody else.
Like everybody else.
Yes. So they wanted to be like everybody else. They had this inferiority complex the way the Zionists did, and they said, we're going to feel better about ourselves if we're like everybody else. And yes, that's what the Zionists did, except the Zionists were worse, because those Jews that came to Samuel, they still wanted to be Jews, and they just wanted a king. It was just a public appointment. These wanted to change Jewish identity. Now, here's the problem. Here's the problem that the Zionists had, and this answers your question about your atheist friend. And this is really the crux of the matter here. The definition of a Jew was whatever the religion decides is a Jew, right? Someone who. Now, if you eliminate that definition, and the Zionists clearly didn't want it, so what is a Jew? What is it? Now, the problem with finding an answer to that question is, imagine somebody who doesn't believe in the number 2, 1, 3, 4, 5, 6. And let him watch him as he tries to figure out what 5 minus 3 equals. I don't know what number he's going to come up with, but whatever he comes up with is not going to work. So that was their problem. Okay, we're the Jews. Well, what are we? Okay, they didn't believe in the right answer. So they had to come up. Jabotinsky said Jews are a race. Now, here's the thing. If Jews are a race, what about the Ethiopian Jews and Yemenite Jews? So there was a big Nathan Salomon, a big Zionist academic from the Hebrew University. He said, yeah, they're not Jews. They're Arab half-castes. They're Negroes. They're with an elongated skulls. And the Yemenite Jews are not Jews. We're consistent. Jews are a race. The real Jews are the Ashkenazi whites. Okay, now nobody really believes that now. Other people said that, okay, so the Jews are they're an ethnicity. But that also doesn't make any sense, because they're Jews of all sorts of ethnicities, right? Again, you have the Ethiopian Jews and you have the German Jews, and they don't eat the same food, speak the same language. They don't have the same history. My family was in Poland for 600 years. I have more in common historically. Our commonality, me and the Ethiopian Jews, until, I don't know, 2,000 years ago, we don't have anything in common. So it can't be an ethnicity. Okay. will make it into a nationality. But what national characteristics do they have? Well, we'll give them national characteristics. We'll give them a land. We'll give them language. They were trying to synthesize something. But now here's a question. If the Jews are anything other than a religion, right? You can have atheist Jews. Question, can you have a Christian Jew? Mm-hmm. Why not? If Jews are an ethnicity or a race or a nationality, why can't they, Christians can be of all races, all nationalities, and all ethnicities. Why can't they be of the Jewish race, or the Jewish nationality, or the Jewish ethnicity? And indeed, Israel Zangwill, one of the early Zionists, said that when we get a state, the Holy Sepulchre will be guarded by Jews of the Christian faith, and the Omar Mosque by Jews of the Muslim faith. Okay, so he actually believed that you could be a Jew. That was their plan.
Wow.
Okay, either we'll make Jews into a race. Yemenite Jews aren't Jews. We'll make Jews into a nationality. Okay, but the problem is that, you know, none of this was palatable for the Jewish people. It's basically, it wasn't attractive. There was a group of Jews, Zionists, called themselves the Kenanim. A guy, Yonatan Rotash, invented it, and his idea was, we're not Jews at all. We are Hebrews. Okay, now the movement fizzled out because nobody ever heard of this nationality or these people. No, why would anybody join it? And the trick that the Zionists had, the impossible task that they made for themselves, was that we want to create this new people, but we still want to retain our Jewish identity. The reason they wanted to retain their Jewish identity is because otherwise they wouldn't get people to follow them. The whole idea was to transform the Jews. Now, you can convert them to another religion, right? But they couldn't invent a new religion.
I'd love to look at another or the other large dimension of this. What does it mean to be a holy people, a nation of priests? This is at the heart of what it is to be a Jew, to what it is to have been called forth, to what it is placing yourself under the covenant and having that relationship. What does that mean?
Well, it means, as I said before, we have different aspirations. We have additional responsibilities. We are put in this world, best analogy I could think of is a business trip. We're here to perform a task, and then we go home. And whatever we produce in this world is what we go home with. Now, it's not only Jews. Everybody in the world is only here on a business trip, and non-Jews also, if they fulfill their Noahide laws, they also get a share in heaven. And if they want, because Judaism is not a race or an ethnicity, anybody can convert to Judaism. We're not a proselytizing religion. We don't encourage it. If somebody wants, no problem. We have nothing at all against people that would like to live as Gentiles. Go right ahead. No problem. The only difference between me and the Gentile is that the Gentile has a choice whether to be a Jew, and I don't. The reason being because you're a professor, right? And I was a teacher too, and you give tests to your students. And as you surely know, tests really aren't a fair way of assessing. Different students need different types of tests, right? And you, because you're not God, you can't custom make every test for every student. But see, God is God. So he gives everybody the tests in this world that's best for them. So God decided in his wisdom.
Everybody's particular.
Yes, so it's God decided in his wisdom that it's best for me not to have this choice for whatever reason. And God decided it's better for you to have a choice. And God does whatever he wants for everybody. But however the dice land, wherever we are in this world, our circumstances that we have no control over, that's the job God gives us in this world. So the choices that he gives us are our choices. The things that are not our choices are, God says, you don't have a choice. And that's our job in the world. The job of, if somebody wants to become a Jew or somebody's born a Jew, and that means by the definition that the Torah gives, our job is to make our life's goals the pursuit of holiness as defined by the Torah and connecting to God through his laws and through belief in him, through the theology, through the various means that God gave us to connect to him.
Is it fair for me to refer to the laws as spiritual discipline?
No.
Tell me about that.
I don't consider myself a religious person in the common, in the classical sense. I'm not searching for spirituality.
Right.
Or anything like that. Here's my thing. I just look out for myself. My family, I have an instinct. I'm a father, I look out for my kids. But that's really also kind of self-serving in the sense that, you know, it fulfills my instinct. The same reason why I don't eat tiramisu for breakfast, chocolate mousse for a snack, and sit in bed a whole day, even though I would love to, is the same reason why I observe Judaism. Because it's better for me in the long run. God said, you're only in this world for, as the verse says, Yimeshana Senu Bahem Shivim Shana Vimagvur Shmoinim Shana in Psalms, the days of our life in this world are 70 years, and if we're strong 80, let's say we live to 120. After that, we're going to be around for millions and billions of more years until eternity. And what I do in this world will determine my status of perfection, which the closest analogy we could envision in this world to perfection is what we call pleasure. The level of my pleasure, okay, what Christians call heaven, the connection to God, which is perfection, will be determined by how close I got to God in this world. So I don't want to spend millions and billions of years in eternity in pain, and I want the maximum pleasure. Same reason I wake up in the morning and go to work and I work full time because I want money in a bank. It's the same, and I save for my retirement. My fulfilling the religious laws is for saving for retirement after I'm dead, or really born, depends how you look at it. The connection to God. Can I give you Jewish theology
in a nutshell?
Do it. Before, and I put the word before in quotation marks, the world was created because there was no time or space, so there was not really a before, but we'll use that word. Before the world was created, there's only God. God is perfect. Perfect in all aspects that you could think of. In fact, we know nothing about God. We just know what God is not. Mm-hmm. God is not imperfect. God is not mm-hmm. weak. God is mm-hmm. not ignorant. But God is beyond. But one thing we know, that he has no imperfection. And certainly, being perfect without any imperfection is a desirable state of being. Now, God, in his benevolence, says, you know what? Being me is really desirable. I would like to share this with others. Right. Yeah. There's a problem, though. God cannot make another God. Mm-hmm. Because in order for there to be two of anything, there have to be borders and boundaries that make one not number two and number two not number one. So God cannot be a multiplicity. God, there can only be one. And one also, you put that in quotation marks, cannot. So here's what God did to solve that dilemma. I'm going to articulate my essence, God said. And that's what we call the Torah. And I'm going to give parts of me sentience. We call those things souls. When God created people in his image, this is what it means. Mm-hmm. God blew from himself the breath of life. Mm-hmm. And as our sages say, when you blow from inside yourself. The word neshama in Hebrew, which means soul, is the same as the word neshima, which means breath. Yeah. So there's a part of God, so to speak, inside us, or you can call it, if you rather, a connection to God. And now we have an articulation of godliness or God's essence. I don't want to use the wrong word and get into materializing God. So if I say something that sounds like that's what it means, don't take it as literal as you would want to, as it may sound. So there's a connection that we have to God, and we have these instructions that tell us how to connect to God. And actually, God more than could be described more than anything else, I can't get into it now, is the first cause. God gave us the ability to choose, gave us the ability also to be a first cause in regard to certain things. That's what an image of God means, and that's what is enabled by the soul. The soul, meaning part of God, means that it's a reflection of God, God who's the first cause. Everything in this world is deterministic. The rules of physics, the laws of causation would preclude scientifically free will, as an increasing amount of scientists are figuring out these days. We knew this literally thousands of years ago because we always knew that free will is a miracle. And it's a miracle because we have that soul in us, which is the image of God. And God is the first cause. We have the ability to choose because, not for any predetermined reason, but because we choose. And if we choose the right things included in this Torah, God says, look, here's a way to connect to me. Now, here's the thing. So far, we only have souls, a Torah, and God. Where's the rest of the world? Well, here's why God created the rest of the world. He said, look, in the Torah, there's a mitzvah. Honor your parents. So guess what? Souls don't have parents. I got to give them parents. It has a whole structure, a whole list of instructions in the Torah, but you don't have the tools to fulfill it. So creating the world, my body, this entire world, the universe, which means everything except God. The only two things that exist, God and the creation. The whole reason why the whole world was created was as tools for people to fulfill the Torah. Now, different people, Jews, have different amount of mitzvahs than non-Jews, and even amongst the Jews, different types of Jews have different mitzvahs, different circumstances, there's different statuses, but whatever job God gave us, that's what we're here for. And when I'm done with my job, God says, you know what? I lent you these tools, this universe, your body, this world, time's up. Soul, come back. And to the extent that I fulfilled the Torah, I am now connected to God and the perfection to the extent that God could enable others to share that perfection, I get also. And guess what? That's worth a lot to me. And I'm willing to work hard to get it eventually. And that's the only reason why I'm religious. I'm not seeking spirituality. This to me is as much a reality as anything else. The spiritual world and the physical world are really one reality.
Of course they are.
You can call it spiritual, which, you know what, in the olden days, if somebody would talk about radio waves, they would look at it as some sort of spiritual entity.
Well, spirituality has become a plastic word.
Yeah. And it's all one world. It's all reality. So I'm not looking for any fuzzy feelings or to make enhance my life. Between sushi and the gym and whatever other things I like to pursue, I'm happy with my life. That's not the issue. But just like I work 40 hours a week in order to, and I put money away for retirement, and I do things because in the long term it's good for me, I also am working towards the goal of connecting to God after my time in this world is up, and I'm there forever and ever and ever, and that's the best prize of all. So it's my own self-interest to be religious. It's not a spirituality thing.
That's wonderful. Just, this is maybe a little bit of an aside. I stand in the Eastern Christian apophatic tradition of theology, and in that tradition, a number of the church fathers and spiritual mothers have talked about how creation is obviously not the essence of God, but that creation is the energy of God. So they make this distinction between essence and energy. The essence of God you cannot know, but the energy of God is this breath that is in the world. How does that strike you?
Okay, I wouldn't use the word energy.
Yeah, what would you
I would use the word, let's say, footprint more, uh-huh. or fingerprint or something like that, or the word of God. It says in Psalms.
The word would be a classic.
Forever, God, does your word stand in the heavens, which means that the word of God, when he said, let there be, that actually became the world. Now, God has no vocal cords, and there's no air to vibrate to create sound. So what we would call the best analogy, again, that I could think of, imagine a little world in your head. And with all the laws of physics and everything, you know, from down to the quantum level all the way up to the universe, the ends of the universe, it doesn't really exist in comparison to you, but comparison to itself, it does exist. In that, that's the best analogy I could think of, and again, it's an analogy, don't take it literally. The world exists as God's will. That word I would use, not energy. It's the will of God. It's the will of God that I should have these eyes, or that these things should function as eyes, meaning that whatever effect the light has on it, I should feel and I should see. Whatever happens in this world is because God wills it so. So I am part of the will of God. Now this is why you see free will as a miracle. Could you imagine that little world in your mind and then give the figures that you're imagining their own free will to act independently of you?
Right.
You see, it cannot be, because there doesn't exist anything in the world except God and his will. Nothing can act independent of him unless God miraculously gives a person part of him, the soul. I mean, he gives him that ability to be a first cause insofar as he can choose to fulfill God's commandments. Where God's commandments are not relevant, I know what color to, for example, a choice of what color to paint my living room, I do not have free will, because it doesn't matter to God. Free will was only given to humans. Everything else is deterministic. Free will was only given to humans insofar as it is a tool to connect to God through his instructions, which means the Torah.
Are you familiar with the kind of medieval theological question which they gave to those young men who were studying for priesthood and what have you? It was common for, in that period, to ask the question, you know, this is a scholastic world. So it's a world in which there's all these notions about what God is, omnipotent, omnipresent, that sort of thing. And the question was, is it possible for God to create a rock that is so great that God cannot move the rock?
Sure, I'm familiar with. The answer is no.
Yeah.
And I'll explain to you why. It's very simple. The answer is no. God cannot create a rock too heavy for him to lift. God cannot kill himself. God cannot duplicate himself. The answer to all these things are no. And I'll explain to you why. Okay, the word for danger in Hebrew is sakana. Can God make a sakana that's not dangerous? Yes or no? Well, if he's omnipotent, he can do anything, right? Well, the answer is that a sakana that's not dangerous, or a triangle without three angles, we'll use that as an example, is not a meaningful concept. It's just sounds that I make that sound like they express a coherent thought, but they really don't. Asking an all-powerful being to create something that makes him not all-powerful is like saying, can God create a mixed-use pickle? Like, yes or no? Well, you say, well, what does that mean? It doesn't matter. Can God do it? Well, first you've got to ask a question that's meaningful, and then I'll answer. Can God make a triangle that doesn't have three angles? No, of course not. Not because he's too weak to do so, but because there is no such thing. God can do anything, but it has to be anything. Go ask me something and ask me if God can do it. The answer will be yes. But this isn't even a thing. You're just saying, can God, blah, 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 can he or can't he? If he's omnipotent, he can.
So let me take it the next step, because I'm really interested in what you will make of this. So the classic response to this question is that, yes, indeed, God not only can do that, but God has done that. And that is the human will. The human will can say no to God. That's the freedom. You have the freedom to say no. That's the only freedom. Is this not also a way of speaking about, as you did so eloquently, about the whole purpose of this world is to enter into, to come closer to God, to enter into that communion that knows no time?
Well, I wouldn't say that the fact that somebody can exercise free will is comparable to God creating a rock that he cannot lift. And the reason is because God can control your free will if he chooses. And God hardened Pharaoh's heart. God chooses not to. So the rock means, can God create something that is beyond his capability? Our free will doesn't enter into any, doesn't describe anything that's beyond God's capability. God allows that to happen by the graces of his will. So that's part of God's power, okay, that he allows us to do this. And that's because, you know, we have that soul. But it's certainly not something that can oppose God. God lets it happen. And even when we say no, we still have a chance to repent.
Mm-hmm.
And then that no becomes a yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So I want to finish by going back to our earlier discussion, but to think just a little bit, given the way in which Christian Zionism has attempted to reconstruct Jewish identity, what do you see as going on with Christian Zionists? I mean, it's so curious to me when I think of Christian Zionists and the ones that I know who are also evangelical Christians, you know, when they have a kind of eschatological scenario about all the Jews having to be back in Israel and all that sort
rapture.
Of thing. The whole rapture, a narrative. But what's curious to me about it is these people are also very, very critical of secularist perspectives within their own societies, within Canada and the United States, for example. But here, they're buying into one lock, stock, and barrel, as if they're completely blind to that's what it is.
There are different religions that interpret scripture differently. It doesn't make them all valid. Some can be refuted. You know, me and my friend who you just met, we have this conversation all the time. I tell him something, he says, well, there are rabbis who disagree. And I say, well, they don't know what they're talking about. And he's like, well, why should I believe you? And I'll say, well, you have no reason to believe me over them, but you have to give me give me that there's a possibility that I'm right. And I'm not a medical expert, but if one doctor says that the opinion of another doctor, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about, could be he's 100% right. And it would be unfair for me to say to him, well, this other doctor says that. Look, the evangelicals have their religion. They read this into the scriptures. They don't particularly like Jews.
That's what's so curious about it, huh?
They don't like Jews at all. Yeah. We are tools for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, listen, there are certain prophecies that's going to happen before the Messiah comes, and things that are going to take place. The rapture, you know, there are different interpretations. I know different opinions about how this works. Of the Jews returning and then either converting, being sent to hell, or being killed, or however it works. This is their religion. Zionism, you see, in order to... You remember that Palestine was under British mandate. British was a hotbed of Christian Zionism. It wasn't a Catholic place. Christian Zionism isn't a Catholic thing. It's a Protestant thing.
Right.
And America, which is, you know, an offshoot of Britain... That's why America and England, first of all, they're always so supportive of Israel. And that's why they have so many Zionists there. So now, in order for... Lord Balfour himself was also a Christian Zionist, and there were many. Lord Shaftesbury, all these people were Christian Zionists, and the Zionists, the Jewish Zionists, knew that if they want a state, that it would be really, really convenient to appeal to these Christian Zionists because Britain owned the mandate. It's pretty much up to Britain. Even though they abstained in UN Resolution 181 in 1948, but this is what they wanted. So what they did was, these Zionists, it's not that the Christians had this Jewish Zionist narrative before the Jews. No, the Christians invented Zionism. In fact, there's a professor of history in Montreal. His name is Yaakov Rabkin, University of Montreal. And he wrote a book, I think it's called Jewish Opposition to Zionism, and in the glossary, Zionism, he says, a Christian evangelical movement was invented by the Christians, later adopted by Jewish Zionists. And he's right. What happened was that, to a large extent, the Jewish Zionists matched their narrative to the evangelical Christian Zionist narrative, which was there for hundreds of years, late 1500s, early 1600s. In order to garner the support of the Brits, which they needed, which would be the best thing possible for them to get this mandate. And they were British Christian Zionists, Dutch, they were in Holland and Britain, various places in Europe that were talking for centuries about let's take over Palestine for the Jews, let's take over Palestine for the Jews. So now you have these Jews looked at these Christian Zionists and they said, guess what? Let's leverage this. Let's make a narrative that matches that. And guess what? And on top of everything, these guys have the mandate. The Christian evangelicals have the mandate.
The God that we don't believe in has arranged things perfectly.
Exactly. And by the way, in 1917, when the British Parliament was voting on the Balfour Declaration, there was one Jewish member of the cabinet, Edward Montague. He said he doesn't want there to be a Jewish state because it's anti-Semitic.
Wow.
He said it'll be bad for the Jews, bad for the Arabs, and it's an anti-Semitic act. What are you saying? That Jews aren't Britons? That Jews aren't Americans? Jews aren't Canadians? What are you saying exactly? That the Jews are some foreign nationality? Actually, Adolf Hitler, in chapter 2 of Mein Kampf, says that the Jews are not really Germans, and I'll prove it to you. Look at Zionism. They say Jews are special, and even the Jews that aren't Zionists don't protest against the Zionists. They don't consider them non-Jews. So this Edwin Montague, who was a Jew, he said, no, you don't want to do this. This is bad for the Jews. And he was, of course, 100% right. The Zionists who had this identity crisis, they were deluded as to what's going on. They just created their religion to match the Christians. In fact, you know, Theodor Herzl. Do you know who introduced Theodor Herzl to the heads of state that he got audiences with? Reverend William Hechler, a Christian Zionist who through his permutations of scriptural verses, he decided that the rapture or whatever is going to come in the late 1800s. And when Herzl printed his book, The Jewish State, he said Herzl's part of this prophecy because that starts it. And he was, I think, the tutor of the nephew of the Grand Duke of Baden or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he introduced Herzl to all these people. Now, Herzl, who did not like Jews very much, he wrote really disgusting things about them. He wrote to his mother, he was on vacation, he says, there are like 20 Jews and Jewesses here, no pleasant sight. Or there are other Jews with long dripping noses and stuff like that. This is Theodor Herzl. About William Hechler, he has the countenance of a prophet, something like that, he wrote. Or a long beard, one of the finest people I've ever met, something to that effect he wrote. And so the Christian Zionists actually recruited Herzl to their cause. And this whole idea that Zionism is a Jewish thing, you know, listen, that's what Netanyahu tells the Jews, but he tells the Christians something else.
Right, yeah. It's lovely to talk with you. I would like you to say in Hebrew again and translate that lovely text about who the Jews are.
And I'll tell you where it is. Give me a second.
You've taken out your Torah.
My iPhone. Okay. Exodus 19:6. V'yatem tihiyu li mamleches kehanim v'goy kodesh. You shall be to me, God says, a kingdom of priests and a holy people.
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Zionism is often an untouchable topic in both Jewish and Christian circles. My own concern is not as a critic of the State of Israel. There is always much to be critical of in nationalist politics, whether in Israel, Russia, the United States, or Canada. The rise of anti-Semitism is a deep concern, as is the colonization of religious ways of being by national ambition and deformed ways of using religion for political purposes. Rabbi Shapiro calls us to a deeper analysis precisely because of his attentiveness to the call of the covenant. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website.